Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and during the pandemic, the constant flow of COVID-19 information and sometimes misinformation in the news cycle can be overwhelming. Well, our next guest is helping lead a team of researchers and students at Brown, MIT, Harvard, Massachusetts General Hospital, and other institutions who are working together on a new resource called COVID Explained, which synthesizes, contextualizes, and organizes many of the things you need to know about the latest COVID-19 news into a succinct and easy-to-understand format. And she's here to discuss her work on various details from that project, as well as talk about some common confusion about children in particular and COVID-19, and how parents can make informed, science-based parenting decisions in this time of so much uncertainty. Joining us now is Emily Oster, economics professor at Brown and author of the best-selling books that some of you have read on the science of parenting, Expecting Better, you know that one, and Crib Sheet. And she's creator of the website now, covidexplained.org. Hi, Emily. Welcome back to WNYC. Thank you so much for doing this with us.
Thank you for having me.
So in the context of your books, Expecting Better and Crib Sheet, and that expertise of yours, what would you say to parents, first of all, who are trying to decide whether it's a good idea to have schools reopen or to send their kids back to daycare or summer camp?
Yeah, so I think the first thing I would say, in line with a lot of what I say in my books, is that, you know, this isn't an easy choice, and not every parent is going to see this the same way. And just like, you know, in a lot of other parenting choices, this is a place where you really want to look at the data and think about, you know, what are the risks to my kids, to my family more broadly, to societal risks, how can I best protect my family? And I think what we're trying to do with the website is kind of start by giving people a little bit of a place to go to get some of those basic facts, which then they can combine with their own family circumstances to try to make these choices.
A recent New York Times article by Apoorva Mendivili titled "New Studies Add to Evidence Children May Transmit the Coronavirus" suggested that if schools reopen, cases could soar. And this is one of the things that your new website, COVID Explained, digs deeper into. And I see you find that there's some conflicting data on this notion, including one case where a COVID-19 positive child contracted the virus on vacation in the French Alps, returned to school, had 112 school contacts, and nobody got the virus. So what do we make of that?
Yeah, so I mean, I think the part of it is like data is coming in and we have a lot of different pieces of data we want to put together. When we look at data, like on that kid who went to three different ski schools and encountered a lot of other children, and also when we look at evidence from Iceland and even some evidence from Australia where schools have been open, we really don't see a lot of evidence that kids are spreading the virus very much. So they definitely can spread the virus, they can get sick, but they don't seem to be, in those data, they don't seem to be a central piece of viral spreading. On the flip side, as you say, you know, there are some kind of model-based analyses. So that's an example of that thing covered in the Times, where it suggests that schools could be a really important piece of the spread. And I think part of what's hard about this is we don't really have the experiment we would want for the data, which is to open schools and see how much spread there is. We're going to learn more about that as this has been happening more in Europe, but we don't really know yet.
And I see the latest explainer you have up is on the recent troubling news that every parent is concerned about, which is coming out about PMIS, or pediatric multisystem inflammatory syndrome, in children. And we had a doctor on last week who's seen dozens of cases of this at a hospital on Long Island, who basically said this is a mysterious new thing we're seeing and we're still trying to gather information. Any thoughts on how or why, even with just one more week's worth of data, this virus may have been overlooked until now?
Yeah, I mean, I think part of what we try to do in that and sort of give people context is that you know, it does seem like there may be a link between the syndrome people are seeing and COVID infection, but it is still very rare. And there are a lot of kids who have been infected with COVID, and most, for the most part, they have mild or even asymptomatic infection. And so I think it's a sort of, there's a balancing act here between telling people, you know, this is something to be aware of. And if your kid seems really sick, you should take them to the doctor. And this is something doctors should be aware of as a possible complication. While at the same time saying, you know, most kids do not get that sick. And, you know, this isn't something that parents should be constantly panicked about. And I've heard from pediatricians who have told me, you know, people are calling me to say, my kid had a rash 2 weeks ago. Do you think that they have this? And the answer is no, they had a rash. And that's, you know, that's, this is not actually, that is not the thing that's going on.
In fact, yesterday, Mayor de Blasio said that 69 of the 147 cases of this multi-system inflammatory syndrome seen recently had also tested positive for COVID-19 or COVID-19 antibodies. And that makes me scratch my head. What do we make of 69 out of 147 also having COVID antibodies or evidence of COVID exposure? Does that mean it is related or does that mean it isn't related?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's hard to tell, right? So this is a sort of symptomatic diagnosis, and there are a lot of different symptoms. So some people would say, well, you know, we think it probably more than 69 of them had exposure because our tests aren't perfect. But you could say on the flip side, you know, that suggests that, you know, the correlation maybe isn't as high as we think. So this is something we're just like, we're going to learn more about over time. When we talked to the doctors and immunologists and researchers who are on the COVID Explain team, you know, I think their view is that it seems at least plausible that these are linked given the symptoms and given what we know about the virus. But it is exactly, you know, how many of those cases are really linked to this as opposed to being cases which we think could be linked because now we're looking for it. I think that's the challenge.
And so how does a case rate like that inform questions of whether to reopen the schools? Because on the one hand, you don't want to put any child at additional risk of something that serious. On the other hand, we put people at risk all the time in order to have society keep going. And, you know, we could name a million different examples of how we don't close down society because there are risks to some people, from allowing cars to be driven to, you know, a zillion other things. So how do you take this case rate, rare but horrible when it exists, into account in making the policy decisions about reopening schools and other things?
I mean, I think that you've hit the sort of the nail on the head, which is we really need to think about, you know, how does this compare to the kind of risks that we seem to be comfortable taking and maybe we're not even thinking about. So, you know, the number of kids who die every year of the flu is far, far, far higher than the number of kids who have died of COVID. I don't say that to scare people. I just say that to, you know, say that we send our kids out into flu season. Some people don't vaccinate their kids for the flu. And we seem to be willing to have schools open, even though the risks there, particularly to kids, seem to be much, much higher. So I think when we think about the kind of choices to open schools in the face of COVID, there are a lot of complications that go sort of beyond those. But we do really want to remember that there are risks that we seem to be comfortable taking. We need to put this risk in that context. I think we also need to think about the flip side. You know, in that same issue of the New York Times, there was an article about how 1 in 5 kids are not getting enough to eat because they rely on school meals. And when schools are closed, there's no school meals. And there's a lot of kids who are falling behind now. You know, 1 in 6 kids is going to need to go to summer school. So, you know, there are real costs on both sides of this. And I think that the COVID risks are so salient, but that doesn't mean that they should be any more important than the other considerations that we have.
You're doing this as an economist, a Brown economics professor, along with people who are more directly in the medical field, from Brown and Harvard and MIT and Mass General, this COVID Explained site. And I wonder if you see the, you know, the two sort of camps of you as coming from different perspectives that it's hard to synthesize. Because when we watch the president's briefings, for example, if he wants to emphasize what's going on the public health side, he trots out Dr. Birx and Dr. Fauci and others, and it sounds like, oh, this is serious, and we're really shutting down the country in various ways because we need to for public health, and here are the case rates and everything else. And then when he wants to go, rah, 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 we're coming back, we're opening things up, he brings out economists who have whole other different sets of data and whole other mindsets. And I wonder if you think that there's a conflict of just the way, you know, well-intentioned people, but from these different disciplines, think about the world and how you try to synthesize that on COVID Explained.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're exactly right that like the sort of economist side tends to think more about kind of costs and benefits and weighing those things. And I think if you're in the public health side, it's easier. On the doctor side, it's sort of easier to see, you know, I saw this patient and I really don't want that to see anybody else who has that risk. And I think, you know, this is part of what has been for me really valuable about this team. You know, when we think about something like what should we write about this PMIS and kids, you know, we have a whole discussion about, you know, how is everyone coming at this? And then someone tries to sort of synthesize it and we talk through the documents. So we really try to get all of those perspectives in. And I've certainly learned like a tremendous amount. And I think maybe they've learned a little bit about sort of how I think about it. But I think in many of these public conversations, we are, as you say, sort of listening to one person and then listening to another person and not really listening to them talk to each other and try to kind of come to some agreement. And I think that's to the detriment of good decision making.
Do kids who have COVID-19 have smaller viral loads than adults? In other words, do they have just less virus in their system? And that's why, as a percentage, so fewer of them actually get symptoms?
We don't know. So there are, you know, some data which would suggest they have similar viral loads. There's a fair amount of speculation and maybe a little data suggesting they have lower viral loads. If they had lower viral load, that could be why some more of them are asymptomatic, but it's not so clear that asymptomatic people necessarily have lower viral loads. I mean, this is like, we're sort of piling on all of the things that we just don't know yet about this virus, which makes it really hard to write about and think about and make good choices about, because even just like very basic facts are not something we've understood yet. So I think we don't really know why kids are not so heavily affected. People have said maybe it's because they get other coronaviruses a lot and that's somewhat protective, but you know, we don't really know.
And I see one of the most recent articles on your site is about the new vaccine trials and specifically the news that one company, Moderna, had some successful preliminary results in early trials for a vaccine that made the stock market go up the other day. Of course, the data set was very small, just eight patients.
Eight people.
But
yeah,
they all developed I guess they weren't patients. They were getting a vaccine, so they were eight healthy people. But they did all develop antibodies. So what do you make of it? What does your team make of it?
I mean, my team was pretty excited, I have to say. You know, it's a small number of people, but I think that this was a good set of results. It's not just that they made antibodies, but they made like pretty high levels of antibodies, which is a good sign. This is a new kind of vaccine, one that is not actually there. I think do not think there are any commercially available vaccines that use this kind of technology. And it is a kind of technology that people think could be really useful because it could be manufactured quickly. But it, you know, it's also like a little bit new. So I think we try to kind of be excited, but there's like a little bit of tempering. And I think it's also worth saying, like, there's a long way between, you know, eight people in a phase one efficacy and safety trial and having a vaccine available. So, you know, all progress is good and this is moving much faster than people might have expected. But we still have it's still distant from having a vaccine that, you know, we're giving to people.
I think President Trump hopes there's going to be one before the election.
Well, Operation Warp Speed is getting off the ground any moment.
That's the federal effort. I mean, do you or do the
right
medical people on your team see any, you know, we should hope for that, right? But is
yes,
it realistic?
I agree. No, I don't think anybody. I mean, the kind of earliest timeline that I heard people suggest that, you know, that I talked to is like early 2021, you know, and I think that would be really aggressive, just, you know, in terms of getting through the trials in terms of safety and efficacy and then being able to actually manufacture enough vaccine to start vaccinating people. I mean, that's a big effort even on its own.
Since your website is COVID Explained, are there some most common misconceptions that you think, even at this point, months into consuming, you know, a constant fire hose of information about the virus, are there most common misconceptions that you think people have?
I think that people are, in some ways, the biggest thing is I think people are pretty confused about how the virus gets in. And I think part of, actually, the thing that I wanted to start with, and we have some stuff on the site about this, was just helping people understand, like, how do viruses work? How do they have to get in? Why would it help to wash your hands? Even pretty basic stuff like that, understanding that, if you don't get the virus in your eyes or nose or mouth, if it's on your hands, it's not going to seep in. That's why we need to wash our hands. And so I think that that kind of knowledge is a little missing and is something that once you understand, it's much easier to organize thinking in your mind about how to prevent this.
So does your group then, last thing, have a take on why so many people are presenting to hospitals now from home who weren't out in the workforce? I'm asking everybody this question now because Governor Cuomo has raised this as a perplexing thing to him. Two-thirds of the new hospital admissions are not people who are essential workers. They're people who are at home, retired, or unemployed.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's really puzzling. I'm not sure we have a take on that. It's something that I have on my list to hear what everybody thinks about it. I think one possibility is that sort of delivery of stuff has a different risk than we thought. But I think I agree that's puzzling.
Or another theory is that those people who wind up in the hospital are the ones who are most vulnerable to disease anyway. So they're going to mirror who's out there in the population. And since most people are staying home, then most people are going to be coming from home. But they're going to be the ones who are older and with underlying conditions and who probably live with people going out to work.
Yeah. And I think it's a sort of recognition that it's hard to live in a hermetically sealed bubble.
All right. We leave it there with Emily Oster, Brown University economics professor and co-creator now of the website COVID Explained.org, as well as the author of her popular books, Expecting Better and Crib Sheet. Thank you so much.
Thank you.